Welcome to the UK's only weekly FM radio show on transportation. I'm Mark Ovenden. Today we're talking about how railways and trams have been managed and whether academics can influence transport policy, plus how a university dude gets fascinated by music and sport. We're joined by Kevin Tennant, who is a reader in management at the University of York. Welcome to the Catchcast, Kevin.
Hello, Mark. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, we're so glad you could be here with us today, and we're going to get to some of those questions we said at the beginning. But I do seem to start all of my guests on the same kind of first question. How did you first get interested in transport and trains, Kevin?
Yeah, good question. I've always been interested in transport and trains. I mean, I had a Hornby or a Lima transit actually from very young. I've still got some of those trains now, actually. So yeah, I've been interested in trains and transport by extension pretty much all my life. I got interested in trams actually also when I was young, because I remember seeing a documentary on Channel 4, I think it was, about the Blackpool tramway, where they were saying, oh, this is, you know, fantastic because we can go along, we cause no pollution and so on. That intrigued me even at a young age, so why, you know, we didn't have trams anymore, basically. So yeah, I've been interested in sort of rail transport, particularly in transport more general, for a very long time.
It's amazing how it starts early and stays with you, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You just sort of start taking an interest in all the kind of news around it, sort of politics around it. I got increasingly interested in kind of business studies and so on when I was at school, as well as kind of history. Started to take an interest in the kind of, I suppose, business and financial side of transport as well. You get interested into all these sorts of different angles of it and the sort of, yeah, the heritage side of it and so on as well, yeah.
How did you follow up your childhood interests in transport and business in your early studies or even your early work, Kevin?
I did history as a kind of undergraduate at university at Dundee, but I did actually do a little bit of stuff on railways there, but it was mostly around kind of cultural, political, kind of military history and a bit of economic history. I was kind of broadly interested in sort of politics and kind of economics as well. And that took me really to sort of get interested in studying kind of economic history in a broad way. And that was the way into sort of studying transport in an academic sense, I suppose.
Mm. And you studied, I believe it was modern history at Dundee, and I think you were planning on staying in sunny Scotland, but you ended up coming down to London. But even when you were there, you were looking back up across the border, I believe.
Yeah, so I got interested in this area of foreign direct investment in history, basically. So companies that were based in one country and invested in things like mining, railways, plantations. So this is in the 19th century, up until about probably 1960, actually, really. I kind of got interested in that sort of area, but there wasn't really anyone at Dundee that could supervise me at the time, really. But I did have as my supervisor there in the last year, that was Professor Jim Tomlinson, who had worked at LSE, and he kind of put me in touch with people at LSE. So LSE had an economic history department, which focused on kind of economic history and business history. And that allowed me to work in that field much more specifically. And it was good because when I went to LSE, you did a certain number of courses. I was lucky enough to be taught by Nick Crafts, who was, you know, very famous economic historian who, among other things, he advised government quite closely on things like growth, productivity, things like this. You used to hear him on the Today programme on Radio 4 quite often, you know, things like this. I was lucky to be taught by people like Nick. You got a sort of a grounding there, if you like, in economics that was helpful. I don't really work with economics anymore to a big extent, actually, but at that time it was really helpful because it took you from humanities into kind of social science, and that was a good environment because on my PhD I was partly supervised by Terry Gervish, who anybody who's interested in the modern history of railways in Britain will probably know Terry's work on the history of British Rail, his earlier stuff on Mark Hewish and the London and North Western Railway as well, and so on. And that brought me into kind of academic business history as a field, and actually brought me into the possibilities of studying transport in a broader way as well. Because I didn't start out trying to study transport. I was interested in transport, but I didn't know the broader sort of literature. So it brought me into that, yeah. Mm. So working with Terry was important. I was also supervised by Tim Leunig, who has just actually become a lord in the new list of lords. So that's quite interesting because he went off to have a very different career.
Hobnobbing with the real academic glitterati there, Terry Gorvish particularly. And I believe you also worked for a while for the Open University, is that right?
So I ended up, basically, I kind of phoned my crowd at LSE among kind of business historians as distinct to economic historians. And business historians focus on basically the history of partly what happens inside businesses as organizations and partly on the kind of history of management as a profession. So there's management history, it's a little bit different, but it's kind of interrelated. So it's this kind of area that's kind of looking at the interface between businesses, why certain businesses survive, fail, whatever, and then broader society and where it fits as well.
Hmm.
But there aren't many universities that teach business history as a distinct area or have departments of it. So this led me into business schools, basically.
Mm.
Yeah, out of LSE, the first place I worked for 2 years was the Open University, which was quite daunting because I started working in strategic management without actually really knowing masses about strategic management as a field itself, apart from having studied the strategy of companies, basically. So I had to learn quite a lot of theory in that field pretty quickly. But it was fun, yes. It was a very different environment to LSE, but people were very motivated by the fact that they're opening up education.
Mm, everyone has a chance to learn, yeah.
Yeah, so they were opening up university education to students who hadn't always had the opportunity for it. I mean, I was working with MBA students there, and a lot of them were very experienced business people, always very interesting kind of different backgrounds and so on. It's a very interesting place to work, the Open University.
So I believe you moved to the University of York in 2012.
I moved there as a lecturer in management. I've been there since, really, and it's quite a nice environment at York. We do have a group that work on business history kind of topics. We've got good relations with other departments in the university as well. Over time, it's become more kind of interdisciplinary. It encourages links across the university. So yeah, it's quite a good place to work, York, for those reasons.
And it's a management school, I understand. And so you're basically teaching people how to go and become managers, I suppose, yeah?
Well, yeah. Well, it's more about the study for management and business. So we now call it the School for Business and Society because it's merged with the Social Policy Department about 5 years ago now. It's not about prescription as such. It's teaching about management rather than for management. So it's ways of thinking about management, if you like.
Aha, an important distinction. Yeah. We are going to get to some of your major research areas in a bit, but apart from being fascinated by transportation and business management, you also have a bit of a passion for sport and music too, I believe.
Yeah, so I've done research on both sport and music. So I've been looking at sport now for about 10 years, and I did a big research project on basically when England hosted the World Cup in 1966, so the kind of preparation project. And that has led me and my co-author Alex Gillett to, we're now looking at the history of the British Olympic Association, the ways in which Britain prepared to host the 1908 and 1948 Olympics. And that's led to an interest in how project management itself actually evolved through history as well. So yeah, so we've done quite a lot of research on this field. And there is a link to transport here because a lot of the ways in which sport is organized, bureaucracy and this kind of thing, it comes out of transport in a sense. It comes out of areas like banking and other fields in the economy as well. They borrow bureaucratic structures, if you like. So yeah, so it's quite interesting in that sense.
And your music side, what have you been doing there?
And on music as well, since I worked on music, but I actually started working with Terry Gorvish on that many years ago when he had a funded project looking at the business history of the music industry. And one area that we found quite interesting there was, well, first of all, we're trying to look at the dominance of the big record companies. So this was the kind of classic period of British pop, if you like, from the 50s through to the 80s. And I went to Colindale, the British Library's newspaper library, to look at the pop charts, basically. And I collected all the pop charts, and Terry did some of them as well, to be fair. But I collected all the pop charts into a database, which we then used to look at concentration in the industry. And we found how basically independent labels had kind of challenged the big labels to quite a big extent. And actually, this was quite important in driving innovation, because in the 1950s and 60s, there were only two record companies, really. So four record companies by the early 60s. So the Beatles go to EMI famously, but there was only Decca, Philips and Pye in Britain, pretty much, that were the alternatives. There wasn't really. So this whole process is quite interesting. And then I ended up looking at quite a lot of material on distribution and the ways in which music was distributed, which was quite important, because, you know, you could only have a hit if you had your records in the shops at the right time. And there was quite a lot of ways of trying to manipulate that as well. So that was one side of it that was quite interesting. But then there was the whole area of kind of, you know, the decline of independent record shops versus larger chains like HMV and so on as well. And that was very interesting in terms of that whole kind of dynamic that went on.
It's amazing how management and business acumen and everything influences everything from sport to music to transport. I want to ask you now about some of your great research and papers on transportation. And first of all, I do know that you have a real major interest in trams, which we both share. I've seen your paper discussing those historic tram systems in York, for example. So for the listener, let's just remind ourselves about the very important role that trams played in people's mobility during, say, the first half of the last century, Kevin.
Yeah, trams are really important because at least 50 cities in the UK had tram systems. They were the normal way to get around for many people. The numbers of people using trams ran into many million into the sort of 1920s, 1930s, and then it starts to decline. But they're really important in terms of looking at worker mobility, mobility for leisure, for recreation, all sorts of things, really, in early 20th century Britain.
That's amazing. So 50 cities in Britain had trams of some kind. That's incredible. And so why did they all rip them all up?
Well, it's complicated. So this is actually one of the reasons that I first started looking at this, really, is that I was kind of interested in this. And then I ended up more focusing really on the municipal kind of approaches to managing them. So what I came to realise was that to some extent, the actual mode of transport was a little bit of a red herring almost. So in terms of trams themselves, one of the problems was that it all kind of comes down to the accounting. So basically, they were understood as businesses, and the local authorities at that time, they could float bonds, they could raise money independently. And the problem was basically that the tramways pay back the capital very quickly. So it's relatively expensive to lay rails. It's relatively expensive to use overhead wires. It was cheaper than the horse trams that you had earlier up until about 1900. That's the interesting thing. And some cities like Glasgow and Sheffield make really big profits out of it. And Sheffield was actually certainly profitable up until the 1930s. Mm-hmm. Glasgow bought a lot of public parks and so on. So it's not that it wasn't profitable in bigger cities, but one of the problems was the smaller cities like York could never really go beyond breaking even. Because one of the problems in this was that I've been right through the committee minutes in York, and I started in York just because it was easy to do without any particular research funding. And it was go through these various stages where try fares 1p, 2p. They try varying this, but one of the problems is that the need to kind of try to break even and to contribute to the kind of the sinking fund, if you like, the need to build up the funds to repay the capital meant that this is financially very difficult. And this is really one of the reasons why kind of a lot of cities get rid of trams. Some of them were even paying this back after they'd got rid of trams.
Oh,
right?
Crikey.
So this was the financial difficulty of tramways. It's quite interesting because, so what happens, of course, in the 20s and 30s is, you know, people are cycling. I think that's a big unaccounted for area. But also, obviously, the rise of the car, which is more flexible. The rise of the motor bus is quite important. There's a lot of legislative kind of shenanigans, for want of a better term, around this, because this leads to kind of bus regulation. So you have the kind of the rise of the bus industry as a big competitor. Then councils are able to use kind of the regulation of the buses after 1930. As a way to control this to some extent. But of course, the other thing is that local authorities, they can start to move to buses themselves or trolley buses. So trolley buses were attractive because you could get rid of the rails, basically, and still use the overhead wire. And that meant that you reduced the cost of, you got rid of the cost of maintaining the rails, but you could still depreciate the overhead wire. So when you build something, for people aren't familiar, you have to think about the asset life and the depreciation of the asset life. So, you know, if a tram, say, costs you £100 to buy, and you're expecting an operating life of 10 years, then you would charge £10 a year for that, essentially. And you try to charge it down in that way. There are various kind of approaches and curves to it, but that would be the kind of general way of treating it. But obviously, what you're looking for is a rate of return, if you like, that exceeds the interest that you're paying as well to buy the thing. So this was one of the big problems. And the 1929 to 31 Royal Commission at a national level kind of underlined this problem. I forget the exact numbers they quote now, but there was something like 20 or 30 million of debt outstanding nationally between different local authorities.
It's a lot of money in those days, wasn't it?
Yeah, so this is the thing. So they say, well, at a national level, we should really discourage the building of tramways.
Such a shame.
And this is one of the kind of the points, really, where at this time, Westminster's really taking more power over transport policy. So you get the Department of Transport from kind of 1921 onwards. And these kinds of policies, yeah, start to centralise it a bit more. So local authorities are kind of encouraged towards trolley buses in the short run, and then petrol buses and diesel buses, really, after that. So, yeah, so the diesel bus becomes kind of normative. I think trolley buses, if I remember, peak in 1943 in terms of mileage in Britain. Tramways peak around, I think, 1927 or 8 or something like that, and start to close in smaller towns. So York closed its system in 1935. So York looked at trolley buses. It only built one trolley bus route, and it didn't really pursue them. It was straight to buses, basically. Other places, like, so Doncaster, where I live, went to trolley buses and carried on with them for another 30-odd years. But again, when you look at trolley buses, you find that when they get rid of them, again, a lot of the same arguments come up. The other thing we haven't really talked about is the fixed link issue as well. So what's quite interesting when you look at transport policy now, one of the reasons for wanting to bring trams back is the idea that they give people reassurance that there's a transport route there, essentially. So it gives a sense of permanent infrastructure. So this is one of the reasons why there's a kind of psychological rail factor, it's called. So there's a lot of people who would take a train but wouldn't necessarily take a bus. So somewhere like London, where buses every 7 minutes or something, right, and it's very visible, that reassures people. When the bus is every 20 minutes, every hour or something, the information cost sometimes of using the bus is quite high as well. So, you know, there isn't always a timetable and things like that. And, you know, all these sorts of things, it's sometimes a barrier for people. So where having a fixed link, having a track, something like that actually helps, because it reassures people, right, that it's going to appear. So the reason for being interested in bringing them back has become this. But on the other hand, that's also a barrier or a problem in terms of, so when you start to get road traffic being introduced on a broader scale from the early 20th century, yes, bringing in cars and lorries is hard to believe now, but there was a positive environmental reason for doing it, because you got rid of all the animal dung. So they were initially attractive, again, cars, but then the problem was is that a tram that can't overtake, has to be overtaken, is in the way of other forms of road vehicles. So it's very inflexible. So trolley buses allowed a kind of middle state. But again, so a reason for getting rid of trams is that, you know, they're inflexible, they get in the way. It's difficult to share them with road traffic.
We are discussing how academics are contributing to the debate about improving transport by learning from the past and adapting for the future with Reader in Management at the University of York, Kevin Tennant. We were hearing about the proliferation of trams and then how some of them got taken down. Well, all of them, in fact, apart from Blackpool. But then we had a revitalisation in the 1990s. Can you talk about how they began to be looked at again and why we introduced modern light rail systems, Kevin?
So yeah, a lot of this is kind of influenced by things that happened elsewhere in the world, and particularly on the continent, basically. So there was a lot of interest from the 1960s onwards in cities on the continent like Karlsruhe, which had continued to have trams, but increasingly segregate them from other forms of transport, basically. So in Germany and in Switzerland, tramways were never fully closed down in the same way. They hung on for a lot longer. And then the thing was in Germany was that there was a special kind of federal petrol tax, which was given to local authorities in Germany to target transport improvements. So some of them started to target improving and modernizing tramways, basically in a way that didn't happen in Britain from the 1950s onwards. And this leads to this kind of new concept, basically, of light rail, essentially, or LRT, as you kind of call it now, so kind of light rail or light rapid transit, which is kind of what we have now in Britain. So in Manchester, Sheffield, Nottingham, you'll have some running on roads, but it's carefully managed quite often. And a lot of the time, of course, it's taking over railway and other kind of alignments that the tramway itself uses as well. So you have fewer kind of conflicts.
We've got a new Prime Minister now who's come from a city that trams helped to regenerate. So do you think that they could be a solution for more towns and cities in the UK outside places like Manchester and Sheffield where they've already got them?
Yeah, definitely, because they're quite important. I mean, they have a cultural role in creating a kind of a sense of place as well. And some people that will use trams that perhaps, particularly in a modern guise, that perhaps wouldn't use buses. They can be more kind of direct than buses because they can run on kind of rail corridors. They can be quicker. Buses, they're also more energy efficient in the long run because they use overhead electric. They're lighter than buses. They also use less energy because they don't use rubber tires as well. They also pollute less in city centres. So I know you have electric buses a lot now, but they're still less polluting overall in a sense than using kind of battery vehicles. They're also more predictable for pedestrians. So if you go to Manchester, you know you've got trams going right through Piccadilly Gardens, the main kind of pedestrian area. You've got it in Nottingham as well. And the reason for that is that you know that a tram isn't going to run you over. It could run you over, but you know where the track is. Mm. So you know to get out of its way. It's also reasonably low speed through there as well. So you can run these quite good kind of integrated systems. Of course, for the passenger, you know, it's quite good if they live in somewhere like, I don't know, Oldham or Altrincham or wherever it is, and they can come into Manchester and you know, it drops them off right in the middle in the high street, which is different to going to the railway station, which is not always that central, is it? So Piccadilly to the centre of Manchester is still a little bit of a walk, for example. So there are various good reasons that trams should be considered. The difficulty in Britain being the institutional barriers, the kind of relatively weak characters of local authorities and so on. So it's quite interesting to see how the new breed of mayoral authorities is seen in Manchester. Mm. The danger in there is that this kind of municipal trading model is being brought back without really thinking about how we're financing it, really. I think that's the potential danger, is that how will we assess in 5 or 10 years whether or not going back to kind of municipal trading, if you like, or municipally run systems is effective? I mean, if they're running at a trading loss, being subsidised by the rates. In the kind of old tramway era, there was a discomfort with that. So in York, as soon as it started to have to be subsidised by the ratepayers, then that was time to get rid of trams, really. So if we're not comfortable with that, you know, we're comfortable with it in London, actually, because we understand that it's important for London as a global city to be competitive. But will we be comfortable with it in regional cities?
Exactly. Put your finger on a good point there. And I think a lot of your work on understanding these realities of transport system management and funding and some myth busting, you do talk about something called the illusion of permanence in the UK transport industry. Can you explain to us what that is in a few sentences?
Yeah, so basically this is the idea that I tried to critique the psychological rail factor now, which argues for trams, by saying, well, basically that existence of rail was actually the reason for getting rid of trams as well, one of the reasons cited. So it was kind of, it tended to be elites that wanted to get rid of it to some extent because they were turning towards road transport, towards the car, basically. So you can use rails as a target, essentially, a reason to get rid of trams, to say they're old-fashioned. And that's one of the things about trams in the early 20th century, was they had an image problem. As soon as it's kind of reinvented as the light rapid transit kind of idea, it's really fascinating. Manchester closed trams in 1947, Sheffield in 1960. The Manchester Guardian, about 1967 or 8, had an article talking about basically LRT in Manchester, and they called it Duo-Rail because at the time it was a fascination with monorail. But they call it that because they don't want to say trams, right? Because they're somehow uncool. But it can be sold as something exciting and new. It's something different.
Futuristic almost.
Futuristic. And I mean, I can remember in the 1990s, 80s even, when like Metrolink, Supertram and so on were starting up. And that was very much the way that they were kind of narrated. The Tyne and Wear Metro as well. Not a tram system, but a light rail system. But again, a very kind of crisp, modernistic, the branding by Margaret Calvert, actually. In that case, probably helped quite a lot. So the way in which the kind of the system is marketed, if you like, almost, and positioned can really help there. So yeah, so it's quite interesting. Something that can be sort of destroyed for being an obstruction, if you like, you can turn that narrative around and put it into a different kind of a context.
I wonder if we will end up turning it around and building more new light rapid transit systems in the future. Kevin, I know that you and I can go on talking about this for a long time, but yep. Sadly, we have come to a close. Thank you so much for explaining the fascinating situations behind all of this to us. Thanks for being here, Kevin.
Excellent. Thank you for having me on.
And you can find Kevin Tennant's work by searching online. Join us next time for more chatting art, transport communications history on Vectis Radio 104.6 FM and DAB.